Thank you ever so much for coming. We're going to go through this in about 40 minutes. There will be some time, untraditionally, for questions at the end. That's just the abstract that you had, in case you can't read it. It's just so I have a memory of what I said I was going to talk about. The public health record of the 2010 to 2018 UK government. I'm going to kind of spoil it now. It's not good. Just in case you were hoping, you know, if you're sitting here and you just come to hear how wonderfully they've done and the people you'd voted for have made a great do of things, I'm afraid the answer is no. I'm also determined not to get miserable about this, because this story is pretty awful, but I don't think it helps to kind of wallow in how awful it is, because we've got to get out of it. The other thing I'm going to do is what people normally do when they give talks like this, which is they go and get the slides from the last talk they did, shuffle them round a bit, and then think, oh, that'll do. But the reason I'm telling you this is I've actually got a valid reason, for once, for doing that. I've gone back 8 years, and I've looked at all the talks I've done over the last 8 years to see when was the first time I found out something about the public health record, and I've put it in order. So all of this is things that have been shown over the last 8 years, but I've never put it all together before to try to see how I've become acclimatized to what's happened since 2010. Okay. We're going back 2011. I'm up at University of Sheffield. I've been invited to a meeting of dentists. I do stuff on inequalities. So I showed them a couple of maps of Sheffield. And this map away from me is showing you the average number of decayed teeth in five-year-olds. The poorest parts of Sheffield, coloured orange. 2 to 3 teeth in your average five-year-old are decayed. And here we've got a map, 2003, 2004. The average number of decayed teeth has gone up. I spent most of my adult life looking for things like this. Like, things to moan about. Things to go, oh, you've got your new labour, but, you know, the number of decayed teeth has gone up in five-year-olds. And they're your five-year-olds, because they've been born since 1997. Okay? And it is important, and it is sad that the number of decayed teeth in five-year-olds rose, but that's what I was doing in 2011. I shouldn't have been doing that. I should have been looking at the government. But I wasn't, because I always use data, and the data is always lagged by 1 or 2 years. So I was worrying about teeth in five-year-olds in Sheffield. And today, that appears to be a kind of utopian situation to have been in. You'll know that teeth are bad. You'll now know that it's gone down. It used to be £10 to buy your own tooth extraction kit, but you can now buy one for £5, so you don't need to find a dentist, because you can't. 2012, I'm in Denmark, because I compare different countries of the world. It's interesting to go to different countries, because you really can do things differently to how we do them in Britain. And here's a couple of graphs. The one away from me is for women, the one near me is for men, and it's the average year of life difference between the best off districts in England and the worst off districts. And in 1999, for men, it was about 10 years. Men in, I think it's Westminster or Kensington, were living 10 years longer than men in the poorest part of England. And okay, it goes up. Yeah, it's another thing to knock New Labour for, and I'm very happy to knock New Labour. If New Labour had done something very different, we wouldn't have got what we later got. And this looks bad. The gap's widening, inequality's widening. But in every one of these districts, life expectancy was going up. But this was the worst thing we'd had to worry about, so we worried about these kind of inequalities. 2013, in Bristol. I come to Bristol quite a lot. This is the Isle of Feeney. Begin to get a sense in 2015 that there might be something more important than the widening gap in health inequalities going on. There might be something more important than dental decay in the teeth of five-year-olds because their parents let them drink too much Coke. This poster was lampooned because of David Cameron's amazing skin. There's something very odd about David's skin. It's remarkably smooth. But there was a series of posters produced for the 2010 election, and then there were spoof posters. And we got the health and social care bill in 2012. If you remember it being rattled and rattled through the House of Commons, and the Liberals at the last minute went, OK, we'll put it through then. Shirley Williams, who'd been such a nice person until then, decided to kind of bang it through. And the usual suspects said this is a terrible bill, but we'd be saying that before. Here's an email. This is an email sent the 10th of December 2012 at 9:36 in the morning. It's a desperate plea by a privatised GP service somewhere in England, willing to do a Dutch auction to see who's willing to go on call that night to actually see patients. We're beginning to get evidence that something is going badly wrong in the health and care services. When you realise that actually nobody will be on call unless one of the possible privatised doctors cracks and goes, actually, if you pay me enough, I'll come out of the pub and I'll do that for the night. The health secretary, he's at the back. Does anybody remember what happened a few seconds after this slide was taken? The consultant burst into the room, insisting that they get out because they weren't properly clean and they shouldn't be there. So there's our David Cameron, now writing in his shed, trying to get jobs, actually. It's interesting, David can't get a proper job at the moment. And at the back is Andrew Lansley. You might have forgotten Andrew Lansley. He's now got stage 3 bowel cancer, terminal. Yeah. He could have changed that. The Secretary of State for Health. There aren't many people who have the power to alter the screening system so that them themselves might have actually lived longer, but he didn't. Anyway, 2012. I'm in London. This is the first time I realised this. I'm in London in March 2014. And I'm putting up slides at a homelessness conference, Homelessness and Health, that show that we know that almost 500,000 fewer old and disabled people receive visits from adult social services by 2013 compared to 2008. Because we'd heard of austerity, we knew there were going to be cuts, we knew the cuts were kind of beginning, but we didn't really know what they were. And we knew the ones that were most shouted about, it was NHS budget not going up and so on, but the ones that were biggest were the ones which were easiest to do, which were the ones that people didn't know that we actually had a small army of adult social workers going out, turning up, taking their coat off, putting the kettle on, making a cup of tea, checking the person was functionally okay, drinking a cup of tea, putting their coat on and going again after 50 minutes. And we complained how terrible it was that these old people only saw somebody once a week for 15 minutes. But of course that's so much better than not seeing anybody a week at all, and you could be at the bottom of the stairs. Meals on Wheels were halved. Rural bus services. Who uses rural bus services? Who can't drive anymore? And then we got the first sign that something odd was happening. By June 2013, 23,000 more people had died in the country than you would have expected if the trend that had gone on and on for years had carried on. Post-retirement life expectancy dropped by 2%. This is the very first small drop. A 10-stop drop, dropped by 2%. Influenza and flu. I'm going to keep on saying influenza and flu and pneumonia to the day I die on this. The government said, don't worry, it's just the flu. It's the first time they said it. They've said it many times, you're going to get a bit sick of this. The good news is, they've stopped saying it finally. It's taken them almost 5 years to stop saying it. It's just a bit of flu. In fact, it turned out the influenza and pneumonia was only noted in 5.8 or 3.5% of cases. So if this was flu, you had to have mass misdiagnosis of flu. There were lots of other things happening, okay? This wasn't easy. There are reasons why people didn't see it all at once. June 2011, the largest private care home provider was about to go bankrupt. It had 752 care homes. It is harmful to the health of people in care homes to think they're about to lose their home. It was posted as a business story. Oh, this has come back again, by the way. This was, what, 7 years ago? The story of last week is private hair care homes don't have enough customers because they've died. And that's posted as a business story. Would have been far better. There were echoes in the past. Harold Macmillan was the minister in 1953, at the time of the Great Smog, who said, oh, all these deaths are due to the flu. He knew they were not due to the flu. We now know he knew they were not due to the flu. But it was a time of austerity in the early 1950s, and he didn't want to change what the coal companies could actually do. And there's the beginning of graphs of this thing. And I'm afraid you're going to see a lot of graphs. I'm just going to go through the graphs very, very quickly. So that's the social care visits plummeting down to 2013. That's the very first tiny, it was just 5.5 weeks, loss of life expectancy at the beginning for elderly women. Elderly women tend to be on their own. This is a difference. Elderly men tend to have a not quite so elderly woman with them. Right, it's like your own mini welfare state. Elderly women, because men and women used to marry with an average age gap of 5 years, and the woman was younger, women lived 5 years, you can see what happened. Elderly women turned out to be the canaries in the mine, the first ones. What was the response? The NHS contracted a private healthcare company to produce, for the Economist magazine, you can't make this stuff up in hindsight, to produce web pages for the elderly to browse. Okay? Really? So we halve the number of adult real human beings going to see them when they're in dire need. You know, you have to be in really bad need to get an adult social worker. And we gave them a web page. And the web page said that you need to keep your main living room to around about 18 degrees and the rest of the house at least 16. But if you can't heat all the rooms, heat your living room during the day and the bedroom just before you go to sleep. Whichever obviously young person put together the HTML for this web page is young and doesn't understand that when you're old, you go to toilet several times a night. So simply heating the room just before you go in and tuck your duvet over doesn't work. Regular hot drinks and eating at least one hot meal a day will help keep your energy levels up. You can imagine my granddad, who never clicked a button in his life reading this. Keep your body warm. Finally, make sure you get the seasonal flu jab, because it's the flu, isn't it? Wasn't the flu. And it wasn't a cold winter. Because just to make it a little bit easier for those of us looking into this, we've had no cold winter since 2009-2010, which was the last cold winter, really cold winter we've had, which didn't see a big excess number of deaths among the normal for a cold winter. 2015, I'm in York, and somebody sent me this graph. I didn't know why this graph mattered. I didn't even know what PYLL adults actually meant. Potential years of life lost. It's going down, you can see it flatlines. Turns out it's target 1A of the National Health Service. It's the first most important target of the NHS, was to improve that. And it stopped improving. I've just chucked some other things on. We also just weren't always looking at government data. This is data about 15-year-old girls in the United States and United Kingdom and the proportion who are diagnosed to be anxious and depressed over time. You see, there's things going on. The key thing for showing you that is it comes from a report which used all the countries for which we had data and said there was no rise. So it's only in some countries are we seeing rising levels of anxiety and depression amongst our young people. It's in the countries where it makes sense to be anxious and depressed because of what's actually happening in your country. This is an old graph of, in effect, Prozac prescriptions, people being given selective serotonin, whatever, reuptake inhibitors. In Scotland, going over 13%. It's now 1 in 3 in Blackpool, 1 in 3 of the adult population are now being given pills to take them away from where they are in their head. Different countries are very different. This is cycling and walking in different countries. If you want to alter the hormones in your body, going for a walk or cycling is very good for you. They don't do it in the United States. They drive everywhere and they get fatter. There's that graph again. So the NHS was stalling on its most important target that it was set, but we were getting almost no news about this. This thing, a bit of light relief. And in a way, this thing helps explain how what happened could happen and could still be happening, and it not be the kind of story it should be. This is the geography of the vote in 2016. You remember this little vote? You know, we collectively make a decision because we're all so well informed and decided to go one particular way. If it wasn't for this, what I'm telling you about now would be the biggest story that you've heard for the last 2 or 3 years. And we got very excited. This is the data about the vote, and got this in the BMJ. The majority of people, in case you don't know, who voted Leave live in the south of England and the social class A, B and C1. It was a middle class Leave vote. So members of the middle class seem to want to tell you it's Middlesbrough, Stoke, Hull and Great Yarmouth. They don't matter. Almost nobody lives there. Anyway, that was going on. It's round here. Go in any direction, 10 miles out of Bristol. Leave majority. That's who it was. It's obviously exciting, that vote. Exactly the same day as the result of that vote came out, not a conspiracy, timetable for ages, the Office for National Statistics released the annual data on deaths. And this is just here for particularly obsessive people in the first two rows who want to read this stuff. But essentially, we had the biggest rise in mortality we've seen since the Second World War, announced suddenly on the day of the Brexit vote. In terms of good days to bury bad news, there's been no day, really, since 9/11, where it wouldn't be seen. Death rates rose 9% overall, 12% for the very old, 10% for 85-year-olds, big. Attributed to dementia and Alzheimer's. Those are actually the causes on the death certificates, dementia and Alzheimer's. Now think of those elderly women. Who's the next frailest group? It's people with dementias and Alzheimer's. Influenza was suggested as a contributing factor. This is what flu looks like when you have a flu epidemic. In case anybody from Public Health England is here and needs a reminder of, you know, flu comes in, spreads across the population, goes up in about 4 or 5 weeks, you've got a flu epidemic, goes down again. Doesn't go on for weeks and weeks and months and years and years. I'm a geographer. I didn't even do GCSE biology. And I know what flu is. And I know what lab reports about flu are. And that's what the flu is. And it's not what we've had. And so I start producing lists like this. And this is a list by calendar year. When was it last as bad as 2015? Well, when you do get flu, it's really bad. 1918 was very bad. It's a 24% rise in mortality, with the biggest pandemic of influenza ever. 1940 was a very bad year. That's the second worst year. 1929 was actually bad, not because of the crash, but because it was a really unusually cold year. 1895, the Great Frost. Medics kind of forget, sometimes just cold can kill you. 1846, cholera. 1849, cholera. 2015. Well, it's quite something to get in the top seven of that list. My friend George, when I first showed him this, told me, "You've made a mistake, Danny, it's an artifact. Whenever you see something like this, it's an artifact, it never happens, don't be so stupid," and publish it in the Journal of Royal Statistical Society. But I'm a geographer, and the great thing about being a geographer is you don't worry about your reputation, because you don't have one, so it really doesn't matter. These are the health components of David Cameron's happiness index. If you remember Smooth Skin David, 2010, Dave said, while he was hugging a husky, doing everything else, he's going to make us all happier, going to measure happiness, and check how it's doing every year. You can remember that, you just can't remember what happened every year afterwards. They did measure it. They produced a useless measure of about 36 components, but four of them were useful. This is the number of people who said they were completely satisfied with their health, the number who were somewhat satisfied, the number who were mostly dissatisfied, you can see it going up, completely dissatisfied going up. 2, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13. Asking people about their health in an official survey and they're telling us it's getting worse, it's getting worse, listen to me. It's getting worse. You know, okay, there was a slight difference. They did use a computer rather than a person between those years, and people were more willing to say, actually, I'm feeling a bit peaky. Those are the numbers which you don't need to see. This is the rise in deaths that occurred. In absolute terms, it's mainly the very elderly. If we turn it to relative terms, it's more the elderly, but there's an age group, 25 to 29, didn't see an increase in deaths. And the fascinating thing about 25 to 29 year olds is that's the age group of highest net in migration to the country. And then we suddenly began to realise, oh, by the way, back then the babies weren't doing too badly. I'm afraid there's some sad baby news to come. This record looks far, far worse if you take out some of the highest rates of in-migration we've ever had. Because the people who were coming in were incredibly fit, young, and healthy. In fact, they were so fit, young, and healthy that one of the strongest correlations with the Brexit vote is with obesity and voting leave. And it's not that fat people, I feel I'm allowed to say this because I'm fit on this thing, it's not that fat people are particularly disgruntled. It's just that people in the areas with the fewest immigrants were the most likely to vote leave. And the immigrants are young, fit and thin. London's full of them. London's Skinnyville. And bits of the centre of Sheffield are skinny. Anyway, if we were to take the immigrants out, oh, as we're doing, then your life expectancy starts to drop already. So it's artificially high. How do we compare? This is public spending as a proportion of GDP. These figures come from the International Communist Organization of the IMF, trying to hurt your brain by making you believe terrible things. We're heading down to 36% of our GDP being spent on public services. The United States manages to be slightly worse than us, and Ireland is a kind of basket case. Let's do it from a conservative point of view. We're a really sensible, low-spending country that's living within our means. And all these countries up here, Finland, France, spending over half their GDP on public services, Germany, Sweden, Italy, don't know what they're doing. That's the other way of putting it. Or another way of putting it. This is the Conservative spending plans in Britain. The Labour manifesto, Andrew Fisher's manifesto, completely ridiculous manifesto, is there. That's the choice you've been given in the biggest election choice you've been given in a generation. It's about 1 to 2% higher spending at GDP. That's the Overton window for where we are. Health and voting. The Economist looked at every possible correlate of the increase in voting for the Republicans, where it happened for Trump, and the best predictor of a vote for Trump rising was poor health. Not necessarily poor health of the individual person, these were better off white men in particular who voted for Trump, but it's better off white men living in areas of declining health in the US. And in Britain, Brexit vote is better off Tory voting, white people, 10 miles from here in any direction but not here, living in areas which are actually relatively falling down. There are fascinating connections between changes in health and changes in voting. These four graphs come from The Economist. They're its dashboard of everything suddenly going on in the NHS. All those carefully constructed measures of 3-hour waits and ambulances and so on. It's kind of like the lights are flashing, it's just going off the dials anymore. male life expectancy in the countries of the UK. See the rise? See, it's plateauing. Remember, it's only plateauing because we've got those young men coming in from Poland and from France and from Germany who are helping to make sure it doesn't actually go down. Oh, and we're sending our old abroad who then don't count in this. Where did David Cameron's dad die? France. Where did Nick Clegg's dad die? France. It's kind of a coalition deal. And there's the female. On Brexit, we weren't paying our fair share into Europe, by the way, because Maggie made the deal, so we weren't paying. Everybody else in Europe knows this. We were actually in there for cheap. But the really unfair part of our deal with the EU was that we were taking their young, fit, educated people that they paid to train in school to come and look after our hospitals and one in three midwives in London. And we were sending our old, rich, and often slightly more obnoxious people over to some of the most beautiful parts of Europe to die. Oh, it's kind of only fair we're going, really. The long-term historic record since at least the 1890s is for a remarkable improvements decade on decade. If you want to be a pedant, you can point out, as two of our referees on one of these papers did, you can point out that the slope for men in the 1970s goes a bit flat. Right? It takes a hell of a lot of cigarettes to achieve that in the 1930s and 40s. Right? But we managed it. Life expectancy for men in the 1970s doesn't go up that fast. But we've managed to beat it now. And that's without mass smoking before people knew smoking was bad for them. We've achieved the same kind of stalling that smoking cigarettes during a war, when you think you're going to die, your loved one's going to die, without a war. Too many graphs, but I did go back over 8 years worth of things. This is the correlation between life expectancy and inequality. These are United States states. If you kind of want to see where the UK is heading, we're basically playing a game of beginning to move into the territory of what kind of United States state are we? Because we're becoming less and less European in terms of our health statistics. In 1990, we were the seventh best country in Europe for neonatal mortality. The countries where it's better to be born were Germany, Sweden, France, Finland, Luxembourg and Denmark. Otherwise the UK. 1990, we were seventh. 2015, we're 19th by neonatal mortality. We're below Croatia, Lithuania, Ireland, Portugal. When I was born, you were three times more likely to die as a baby in Portugal. We're 19th. If you want to know where we're heading, Romania, Bulgaria, Latvia, Malta, Slovenia, Hungary. And if you think that's slightly alarmist, this is 2015. Since 2015, we only learned this year, infant mortality has risen significantly, because there is a slight bit of randomness, but it's been measured, it's different, not just once, but twice. Absolute rises in infant mortality in the UK. Nowhere else in Europe. You can find it in the United States of America, you can't find it anywhere else in Europe. More grieving parents last year than the year before, more grieving parents that year than the year before. What does a government have to achieve to look incapable? Why don't you know this? Why isn't it reported? It's reported in The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Times, The Sun, The Mail, The Mirror. It's reported on Russia Today, it's reported by Sky, it's reported by everybody, except for the BBC. Except for the BBC. Because, to be slightly charitable to the BBC, how do you report absolute rises in dead babies in a politically neutral way? You go, oh, something happened today. You know, that's part of their problem. But I think the other side of it is you have to understand that the BBC isn't actually the British Broadcasting Corporation. It's the Ministry of Information. And the Ministry of Information isn't going to tell you bad information. No. The last time we had 2 years of rising infant mortality with two particularly bad years during the Second World War. But in general, the Second World War was actually good for babies. But that's the last time. Nowhere else in Europe has this. Oh, and before you think, it's not health tourists. It's not people coming in from abroad. And it's not those fit young foreigners whose babies are dying. These are English-born babies to English-born mothers in dire circumstances. But they're getting worse. 2015 was awful. 2016 was just as bad. 2017 was just as bad. And they stopped talking about flu. And then 2018 comes along. And we were a bit worried because there was a new variation of flu down in Australia and New Zealand. But suddenly we start getting huge, absolute rises in deaths. This is not due to aging. We actually haven't seen aging yet because people are having fewer babies in the past, and aging doesn't suddenly happen. We have looked into whether we actually have. Steve Smallwood is the best demographer in Britain in ONS. And we've been in contact with Steve Smallwood to say, is there any chance there's been an armada of small boats like Dunkirk secretly taking old people from Spain back into the UK to actually cause the absolute and fast rise in deaths? So this is the increases in deaths each week of this year for the first 16 weeks. What was unusual about these 16 weeks, at least the first set of them, was that every routine and non-essential operation was cancelled across the whole National Health Service in England for the first time because the service was overwhelmed because it was underfunded. And this happened despite that. So if they hadn't done that, what would have happened? You're laughing less because it becomes harder to make it funny, because it is hard to make it funny. All kinds of things are going on at this time. People are in situations where the local authorities have been cut for year after year after year. They have to make choices between different people. Somebody is getting more neglected than somebody else. You have to decide when you have all the trolleys on the Monday morning. It's the Monday morning when the families who've been keeping their elderly relative going during the weekend give up and bring them in. When you have the trolleys queuing outside in the John Radcliffe Hospital in Oxford, do you shuffle some of the ones from the back forward who are a bit younger and bypass some of the people in the late 70s who are going to be waiting 8 hours before they're seen? Those are the kind of decisions being made 2 miles from where I work every Monday morning. Infant mortality, inequality in the past. These things are very linked. It is far too blithe just to put this up and just say inequality explains everything. What it is that countries that control their rich control much else about themselves, and are places that make sure that, for instance, neonatal mortality is kept down because you have enough staff in your midwifery units to deal with a surge of people needing attention and babies being born. I've only got about 5 minutes left, so I'm going to zip through these quickly. This is the increase of deaths in prisons, which you'll have heard about, which is mainly suicides. Huge cuts to prison officers. Police custody, good news story. There are good news stories. Detention centres were a good news story until recently, they've gone up. The one nobody spotted was mental health detention centres. People in secure psychiatric units at this time of cuts. Now, it's not actually as bad as that, because they were failing in their duty by law to actually record the deaths earlier. One of the issues about this, about why there are a couple of weeks which aren't extreme, one is Easter and the timing of Easter. But sadly, one of the things going on is that they're being cut to the number of people sitting in Newport in ONS taking the certificates and turning them into numbers. So if the number of people taking the death certificates and turning them into statistical tables is cut, and you have an increase in the number of death certificates coming in, then some weeks you don't get them all in the system. So your weekly numbers aren't actually working. So that's all been very dehumanised. I haven't shown you a single picture. I'm going to show you Connor Sparrowhawk. Because Connor drowned in the bath in the Slade, very near to where I grew up, completely unnecessarily. And you may know about Connor, because Connor's mum wouldn't give up. And because Connor's mum wouldn't give up, this became a national case, and eventually the people at the top were sacked. But the real reason why Connor died in the bath was the cuts. And the real reason why we have life expectancy flatlining and falling down is the cuts, and the reason why mortality rising is the cuts. And the cuts aren't necessary. So why are they doing them? They're doing them because they think they are necessary, not because they can't find the money, because when they need to find £1 billion to make a deal with the DUP, they can find £1 billion. They think the cuts are necessary because they think the kind of shared socialist system that looks after a boy like Connor is bad, and we should have competition, and we should have a privatised health and social care service. That, in the end, is what is going on. I didn't believe that 6 or 7 years ago. I thought they were just a bit stupid. I thought they really thought it was flu. I didn't realise that they knew they were lying. I didn't realise that they were deliberately running it down. But it becomes obvious that they are. This is the league table of inequality. If you want to know where we are, the most unequal countries in the OECD are Mexico, Chile, Turkey, United States, Lithuania, Russia, and then there's us, the United Kingdom. This is the OECD's measure of inequality. We're more unequal than Israel. We only got here because we've had successive governments who are in favour of us being very unequal. The list is too long and I don't have enough time to tell you about all the other countries, but at the bottom, Slovak Republic, Iceland, Denmark, Norway, Czech Republic, Finland, Sweden, and so on, and they all live longer. These kind of cartoons help sometimes. This kind of thing isn't normal, it's normal here. This is a rather underpaid investment banker. These are some slightly higher paid than average care workers. In a normal country, your banker would be paid far less, and the care workers would be paid far more, and the care would be far better, and what the banker does would be done worse, which is great, because what the banker does is rob people. So you don't want your bankers being as good as their jobs as possible. I know I sound a bit cynical, but there comes a point when you've done this so long, you just want to say it. I grew up at a time when we used to pay bankers less than doctors. Doctors were in the 1%. Somebody has to be in the 1%. We used to pay bankers less than doctors. Can you imagine that? How wrong we had it. Because obviously bankers are so much more valuable than doctors. Things are beginning to get through. I don't need to tell you where that is. The view's looking north. So you can work out what the difference in life expectancy from the ward you're seeing, the picture taken into where it is. Things are changing. Attitudes are beginning to change. That's the first graph in the British Medical Journal, done by David Taylor Robinson, showing infant mortality moving away. It was the poor babies that started dying first in higher numbers, the red line. Then the average babies went up, and the middle class babies were doing okay, but not in the last 2 years. I was asked recently who's responsible, because they did a press release of the British Medical Journal saying that people should be held to account. And so my definition of who's responsible is anybody who's called a health chief is responsible for health. The four chief medical officers of the United Kingdom are responsible, none of whom have said anything about this in 10 years. None of the chief medical officers yet. Dame Sally is finally going to do it in her next report next year. Anybody whose job title includes Chief Knowledge Officer for Public Health is responsible. Anybody who's called chief executive of National Health Service or chief nurse and so on, they're responsible. That was why we made the list longer, but an idea. And please be subtle about this. I'm going to make this bigger as time goes on, and I'm going to reduce the number of slides, but UPIM is the correspondent for health for the BBC. hugh.pym@bbc.co.uk. Don't all do it now, but over the next week, just send you an email and just say, I've noticed there hasn't been much reporting about the state of health in Britain, and you're the health correspondent at the BBC. You, would it be possible? Just subtly, because it's got to that point with the BBC. There's lots else going wrong. This is the rise in families of kids, all families of kids in England having to private rent. It's now well over 25%. We are in the middle of a disaster. You wouldn't have expected, unless you think it's wonderful to return to a time when parents with small children are having to pay to a landlord and have no idea how long they can stay in the house or their kids can go to the same school. Right, there's a lot going on at the same time. What can you do about it, or the optimistic thing? There are lots of reasons to be optimistic, of which the biggest one is June 2017 and the largest political swing to ever occur in the history of Britain. Right, there are reactions to things. You might think that the 1945 swing was bigger, but that occurred over 10 years and with a war. What happened in June 2017 was unprecedented, and it's possible. It just requires a clear and consistent message. The swing was almost 10%. Ed Miliband, nice man, didn't quite manage a 2% swing. Gordon Brown managed negative. Blair, negative, negative. Apart from 1997, the 1997 was not about Blair, that was about voting out a different party. Right? So the political trends are extremely interesting at the moment. The impossible just became possible and happened. So being negative and thinking nothing much can change, you can't say that after June of last year. Different societies are differently shaped. This is the society we're on. The good news about this kind of a society is that it really isn't much fun all the way up very near the top. There isn't a set of people in the top 5% or even 2% happily rolling in it anymore. The thing that makes me happiest of all this year is Martin. I won't give you the long story. But inequalities in income for the poor began to diminish in the 90s, and then for the 1% began to diminish in 2015, but the 0.1% carried on moving away and away and away. So every time we thought we were getting somewhere, we were affecting that Gini coefficient, not being the most unequal country in Europe. The people at the top kept on taking more until Martin Sorrell resigned, as I have to call it, because he can afford lawyers, the highest paid person that Britain's ever known. And that was the moment at which we hit peak in income inequality. I'll give you more than Martin. You're looking incredulous at me. So last year, the average chief executive officer in Britain saw their pay cut by £1 million. And the reporting of it was, they're still paid too much, which is brilliant. But you don't have to despair completely. This is my final slide, so please have a think of some questions. It's just a few words to say that something is going on right now. The reaction to increased numbers of people dying, increased poor mental health, services pulling apart, schools losing their funding, is that people are getting angrier and angrier and angrier about it. You don't notice them getting angrier, because you're one of them. And nobody thinks they're angry. Everybody thinks they're normal. It's like being in the traffic. You know, you just think you're not part of the problem. But you're getting angrier. You're not happy with what you're seeing. You're willing to contemplate ways of solving this that you may not have been willing to contemplate 10 or 20 years before. It's all entirely solvable. You simply have to take out of power the people who are trying to destroy the health and social care system of the country and recognise that that is what they're actually doing. The amount of money needed to fund the health service is already there. It's already in the country. The staff is there as long as you don't send them all back to the mainland. You know, it's possible to work out ways to get them back in again. You can't train people that fast. And you certainly can't persuade people from England to go and work on NHS wages in the middle of London like you can persuade people from elsewhere in Europe. But all of these things are solvable in a remarkably short amount of time if you're willing to actually solve it. The alternative is you believe Jeremy Hunt and his 23 press officers. And I honestly don't think most people are going to believe them for very much longer. Thank you very much for your attention.
So as Danny said, he's happy to take questions. You know, what continent is Vanuatu in?
I didn't go to the honeymoon to Vanuatu.
I've got one.
Oh, wait for the mic.
Hi, thank you for that very interesting talk. So I was reading a bit as we talked beforehand of some of your work in which you used a phrase that that this income inequality isn't sustainable and that we're potentially moving into a kind of more egalitarian urban steady state.
Yeah. Okay.
Could you please talk more about that?
Yeah. I mean, the UK is extreme, but worldwide, in most countries of the world, income inequality is currently falling. Worldwide, in most countries of the world, life expectancy is still improving by at least a third of a year. It really is only here and in the United States and Israel that things are very, very bad. But it's just that if you're used to here, you think, oh, they must be bad everywhere. But the good news is that they're not. The incredibly high levels of income inequality and wealth inequality that we have aren't sustainable because they require you all to be stupid. We're sending half of all young women to university, and somehow we're going to have to teach them so badly that they don't figure that most of them are going to lose out. So it doesn't work. And the fact that we've seen Martin Sorrell's drop, for those who don't know Martin, who has remarkably bad skin, by the way, don't envy people who spend their lives in jets going around, private jets going around the world. It's very bad for you. Martin Sorrell's job was managing the largest advertising company in the world to try to get people to buy things they really, really didn't need so we can heat up the planet even faster. That's one reason to be grateful that Martin Sorrell is no longer doing that job. But it's unsustainable. It requires human beings to become more and more stupid to accept that a small number take more of everything and the living standards of the majority drop. You've got to have pretty low faith in people to think you can convince you all, you know, just go and buy lottery tickets and then one of you could join them and you just put up with it. Got another one?
John. Danny, that was really, really enjoyable, and I'm a wet lab scientist and medic by training, so I always like to see a control group, and I've had this curious experience of being in Bristol for nearly 3 years now, having previously been in Edinburgh, and by virtue of the position I've had at the university, I've been a non-executive director of the Scottish Health Board, and for the last 2 years I've been a non-executive director of the Trust. So on the one hand, we've got arguably a slightly better funded health service, slightly better integration with social services, obviously a slightly different demographic, and down here we have fragmentation, we have privatisation or quasi-privatisation. We have the purchaser provider split. You can probably guess which system I prefer.
Yeah.
Is there any way, given what you've shown us over the last 10 to 15 years, of actually drawing a direct comparison of what's happening in the UK?
Yeah, of course. You could. George will tell you that we should have defined it before it began for it to be credible, but there is one comparison that works, which is the infant mortality.
Right.
Scottish infant mortality is now lower and it's still improving. So Scottish babies are not dying. English babies are dying in greater number. And Scotland invests in particular in maternity care and does that. But for it to be a fair comparison, particularly given the numbers you're talking, you should have specified that as a test beforehand. Sadly, for elderly people, despite the way things work in Scotland, the SNP are not quite enough to help. So for elderly people, the deaths have been just as bad. But the budget's still controlled by Westminster, essentially. The Scottish elderly population is more frail because rates of smoking in the past were higher because mass unemployment came to Glasgow in 1977. But these are unfair comparisons because I'm making them afterwards. But the babies and the children are the best evidence that Scotland doing things differently has had a benefit. And Scotland is looking to Scandinavia, where the infant mortality rates are half to a third of what they actually are here in the UK.
Thank you.
Tony,
just a quick
comment.
You said that the healthcare bill is slightly less, it doesn't cost much more to put back to Are we saving
a
lot more money on the pensions bill?
Yes.
Okay, on the pensions bill.
Yeah. Financial Times story, yes. We are saving 130 billion on private pensions. And that, of course, is to better off people because of the deaths. So, in a way, the worry is that this is rather like unemployment in the 1980s, when it was said to be a price worth paying for getting us out of some hole we weren't really in. The worry is that, and I hear this as well, people do say to me, if you got to cut something, dying at 83 rather than 81 is something that you could cut. So the pensions bill initially appears to be saved. The problem is that the whole country is getting iller and we're being less productive. Our productivity flatlines. So we're not going to be able to pay for our pensions in future as we are anyway. And the other problem with it is that it's not a very quick going at 81. It's actually absolute misery for 8 years and then dying at 81 rather than nice life looked after for 8 years and then dying at 83. And it's also your futures. You know, it's what is your old age going to be like? That's one way. So the ONS predictions, which came out last year, have 1 million years of life minimum being lost in the next 40 years. Most of it to people currently aged between around about 30 and 55. So how many people in this room are aged between 30 and 55? Yeah?
Youngsters.
It's you! Yeah. And you're the predicted bulk because, you know, we've actually got through most of this.
So the pensions companies are doing amazingly well. If you read the Financial Times, the annual reports, the one group of invest in pensions companies, the one group of companies which are just showing increasing profit.
And the amazing thing is that we had a strike over our pension in academia, which we're not immune. Turns out that our pension's entirely affordable, unless you make the world a better place.
Well, for three last questions, that's yeah. Quick.
I'm glad you're so positive about what we can do about this in terms of, you know, the Jeremy Corbyn vote. Can I ask, are you advising the Labour Labour Party, who will be hopefully our next government?
Quick one. Lots of people are, too many are. This Saturday I sat next to John Ashworth. It's not so much advice, he's a Shadow Health Minister. It's not so much advising as helping them step to the left.
Yes.
And John Ashworth sat between me, Oxford University posh professor, and a GP who stood against Jeremy Hunt. And it helps Jonathan Ashworth make his views more robust about what he'll want to do. So the interesting thing about the Labour Party at the moment is, except for Rachel Reeves, and a few others, all the MPs are slowly moving in line towards the left because they can see where the future lies with their party. And anything that helps them stay in and tiptoe across to the left will help. The left, by the way, just means a normal social democratic European party.
Yeah.
But they need help, the MPs, because they joined when they were young under St. Tony Blair.
Because it would be great if you could get all this information out to a much wider audience, as you quite rightly said earlier.
Yeah.
You know, it maybe people just don't know enough about it.
It can, but
I think, that would be brilliant if you could.
Yeah.
Second last question from an unashamed Blairite.
So, I usually disagree with George, but he's of course correct. You were very transparent in showing at the beginning how you were measuring the success of government in 2010, at the end of the Blair Brown years, and now you've shown what's happened since then. So supposing you get the government you want, what would be your measure of success? Would it be about absolute improvements in the way that you showed used to happen when we took those for granted? Or is the most important thing relative inequality, which, as you showed, was what you were talking about 8 years ago?
It would be absolute. Absolutely absolute now. So infant mortality has to drop, just in absolute. Food banks have to go. That just has to go. People sleeping on the streets needs to almost end within 100 days. So initially it is absolute, just to get back to a level of decency. And once you've dealt with the absolutes, you know, the terrible thing, then you can start to worry about the gap a bit more. But things are so bad now that it literally is absolute measures. And you can say a Labour government will have succeeded if infant mortality has fallen this year compared to the year before or the year before. If life expectancy rises, and you can expect changes that quickly, because a lot of it's got to do with care. There are a lot of things that simply should not be happening right now. The absolutes that got better in the past were partly because they were getting better everywhere. I mean, to make it absolutely worse for people is quite difficult. The amount of mismanagement in this country, nowhere else in Europe has got rising infant mortality. You know, it's spectacularly bad. But we also don't have a broadcaster telling us it, which is part of the reason why it can be this spectacularly bad, because your government isn't telling you, you know, through their state-funded broadcaster, in effect, what the basic social statistics of the country are.
So does that imply that what you would count as successes for a future Corbyn government would be the failures of a previous Blair Brown government?
Not necessarily, no, because you'd want a lot more. For if you go further, but you're only talking 5 years if you're being realistic in the first case. To give you one example of what Blair never did. Blair never got the take of the 1% got bigger and bigger and bigger under Blair. So we've got the 1% take the most. You definitely want that to go down. But you also need to create an education system. Bristol, you may have a wonderful school system in Bristol where you're all happy with your local state school, like they are in the whole of Germany and France and the Netherlands and so on. Or you might not have a wonderful school system in Bristol. So you do actually want to be moving towards a school system where more and more people are very happy to use the state-funded school system. And that's one measure. I wouldn't stop people using private. But yeah, apart from Chile, we have the highest private spending in the OECD. So I'd have a whole set of more ambitious targets than Tony Blair hit. And no wars. Stop killing people in other countries. It's a very bad thing to do.
Last question.
Thank you for a fascinating talk, and thank you for mentioning infant mortality. I'm a newborn specialist, and everything I've looked at so far published on the infant mortality rate, it always boils down to perinatal causes, and no one's really drilled down into that. We don't know why the infant mortality rate is so high in this country. But the good news for Bristol is we're going to be hosting the National Child Mortality Database here for the next 4 years, which means it's within our power to actually work out why infants are dying and why children are dying.
That's great.
Yep.
In a way, you know, one sort of sad but repercussion of this is that we are the natural experiment. If you want to help tell people in other countries that are more equal, what goes wrong? The evidence comes from here. The other case is America. You know, in Texas, they closed 3/4 of their maternity units for mums, and infant mortality rose the fastest anywhere in the US. But some people need to be told that's what happens if you do this. I'm very glad you got it here. There's work in Bradford, where it's high and looking. And the other case that needs to be looked at in much more detail is Northern Ireland, because Northern Ireland has the worst infant mortality rate in the whole of the UK and almost the whole of Europe. It's only one part of Europe that's worse than Northern Ireland. And we just sort of go, oh well, it's Northern Ireland. You know, it's an incredibly colonial attitude to part of the country. And it just requires people saying, this is not acceptable anymore, and because I've got the last word on it. I'm beginning to say, and they are doing it, not so much Jeremy Hunt, because I don't think he's all there, he's just buying his flats to get richer. Simon Stevens knows what he is doing and why he's doing it. And it gets to a point when you cannot say anymore that they're ignorant of the repercussions of what is happening. And I think we have to start saying, you clearly know that this is the result of what you have colluded with. And start saying that loudly, because the benefit of the doubt has to begin to go now. And that begins to scare them. If you say you're going to be brought in front of select committees and asked, when did you first realise more people were dying and what did you do about it, then they may begin to change the amount of which they're willing to collude with other people who are happy for this to be going on. Thank you.